somebody sends me a picture saying, can you clean this? I will just very often see pound signs thinking, actually, I'm only doing this for a business.
Yeah.
And I want to earn more than a living out of doing this because it's pretty horrendous. Therefore, I don't, that's my job. You've got to be a certain mentality to cope with doing that kind of work.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the podcast. Today we are talking to Ben. Now this is a crazy story. So Ben actually started as a window cleaner, and quickly from a window cleaner, he became a professional crime scene cleaner. He draws the curtain. He opens our eyes as to what goes on behind the scenes in this podcast. He discusses how he cleans crime scenes. He discusses some of the most horrendous things that he has seen. And honestly, it is really interesting to get the curtain drawn and be able to see what goes on a little bit more behind the scenes, because this isn't something that we normally are privy to. We don't get this information. And on that note, my name is Harrison Brown, and this is the Into the Mind podcast. And I really hope you guys enjoy this conversation. What happens when you see this body on the ground, and it's you know, the first time you've been exposed to this, you need to clean it up. What happens with the body once you've cleaned it up? Like, I've always wondered this. Where does the body go? What's the process of getting the body there?
So 99% of the time the body has been removed. So we will get there. The coroner's office, undertakers will have taken the body away. There are scenarios where we attend and the body is still there. So I'd say if there's been a hoarder's property and lots of stuff is falling in on top of someone, then bizarrely now, I think it's because of the Harold Shipman case, where that doctor was kind of pronouncing people as dead on his own, and he ended up, I think he was like one of the biggest serial killers of the UK, because he was just self-diagnosing people as dead and could kind of play God in a sense with what he was doing. Yeah, it's worth having a read of what he did. But on the back of that, there was a ruling that two doctors had to sign off someone as being dead. So had to have two GPs there. So we've been to scenes where, you know, literally the body is has decomposed, been there for 6 weeks, 8 weeks. You've just got what looks like leather. You know, we've uncovered all of this stuff off of them. It's just like leather wrapped around a skull. Bizarrely, the hair, the beard will still grow, nails will still grow. Which is quite bizarre.
Well, why is
but
that?
You get this, I don't know. I have no idea. And you get this strange situation where there's no life there at all, obviously. And a doctor has got to come out and pronounce this person is dead. And then another doctor has got to come and pronounce this person is dead. And then the undertaker will take that body away. That's the only real time when we come across the body. More often than not, it's just the fallout from it that we're cleaning up. And I've been to scenes where, you know, where you've got a shotgun suicide, as I mentioned before, someone's committed suicide on a stairwell and it's all the way up the stairs. You've got tufts of hair, you've got bits of skull, you've got brain, you've got skin all over because the impact is so great. And then I've been to other scenes where you've got a decomposition of, say, a 30 stone guy who's decomposed through three or four layers of rubbish or mattresses or whatever. And then, but you might also go to somewhere where there's an elderly lady who was like 6 stone and she's passed away, been there for 6 weeks, and there's just a stain on the bed. That's it, just a little stain, because her body was so small and the fat content was so small that there's no real massive fallout from it. So yeah, it just depends. Just totally depends what's happened and who the person was.
And is it that quick? Like how? This is such a morbid question to ask. But if, let's say like older people, when they die, they have a tendency to lay there for a while, because a lot of the time older people don't have as many friends and not as many people are checking in on them. If they're, let's say, 10, 12 stone and it's a guy, how long would he take to kind of like essentially disappear?
Yeah, I know. I mean, it would be great if there was some kind of chart that you could just look across, but it's dependent on the temperature. So in the room, so if, I mean, I've had situations where bodies have fallen onto to like electric fires, and then you get very, very quickly, it kind of, the body fat gets, not atomized, but it ends up becoming airborne and sticks to all the surfaces. So you've got like a whole, the whole room is covered in that body fat. But yeah, very often if it's a cold room, a cold place, it can slow it right down. And also insects. So we'll go to a property where, if blue bottles and or green bottles, they're called blowflies, if they've got in there quite quickly, which they normally do, I think they can smell decomposed matter like a mile away. They'll squeeze in, and if that process starts happening quickly, then you can get a body that's actually broken down incredibly quickly. But I would say for us normally, if it's over kind of 4 or 5 days, then from that point on, you start getting this fallout, which is normally when the body fills with gas, the torso, and then will not burst as in explode, but it will split, and then you'll get that fallout, and then lots of body fluid will start coming out of that person. So yeah, it's a bizarre industry, and I could see from your face that it's not something that you've come across or that you'd think about, but every scene is different. So, and depending, I've been into scenes which are quite interesting. Is say if there's a carpet, and underneath the carpet, someone's put a piece of vinyl, you know, it was an old piece of vinyl underneath it. And you presume that all the body fluid is in the corner where the body lay. But actually you walk in, and 6 meters away, you're walking through body fluid in carpet because it's all sloped in the room. So it can affect lots of different areas.
Oh my God.
And also if somebody say commits suicide in a loft, they hung themselves, and they're the only person there, then you get the same procedure, you get the same decomposition happen. But that body will then drip and run, follow cables, lights, switches, plug points, etc., all of that, pipes, and it'll fall all the way down to the ground floor. So you might have this massive saturation. But again, if it's nice and warm in the loft, it's increased. If there's flies in the loft, it's increased. And then you've got all the other same fallouts, that the insect maggots, sometimes you get huge swathes of maggots, and then the odor to deal with as well, and the waste.
And how would you deal with it? I have this really vivid memory of I'd gone across to, I travel a lot for a living. I'm a photographer and videographer. So I went to, I think I went to like South America, and I was on a shoot for 2 weeks, and I came back. And essentially what I'd done is when I'd left, I'd put a chicken carcass in the bin. And then I got back and thought, oh my God, the smell was right. And then I lifted the bin and it split. And just maggots it stank for like 2 weeks. How do you? What's the process of getting rid of that smell?
Yeah, it's weird. You have to get rid of the material first of all. It's very similar to any kind of disaster where you've got either sewage or fire damage or whatever. If you leave any of that material in there, you'll never remove the smell. But it's kind of working through those stages. So for us, first of all, we'll remove all of that. We'll sanitize as we go in. So working our way in. And different kind of to normal cleaning, where you start at the end of the room and work your way back, we will start from the door and work our way in. So everything behind us is clean and sanitized. So working our way in. And then we'll come across, whether it's body fluid or material or whatever we're cleaning up. But then the deodorizing process will normally start when we've finished removing all of that. And then we can either use machines, they call ULV, ultra low volume fogging machines. So they atomize product. So enzyme based products to eat protein smells. So they will pull all those protein smells out of the room. So that enzymes were brilliant for doing that. And then once the room is dry, we use a machine called an ozone generator, which that purifies the air. So basically it creates O3 instead of O2, and O3 can't exist in our atmosphere, therefore it oxidizes back to O2 once you've made it. So all of the smells contained in that particle of oxygen just to get oxidized. So it cleans the air, purifies the air, and that's a great way of cleaning through. But things like soft furnishings, if you've got mattresses or sofas or carpets or curtains, it's not really worth attempting to clean them. It's just best to remove them.
Right. So if someone has, God forbid, you know, died on a mattress, you get rid of the mattress or a couch.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can, it depends how long they've been there and what's happened. But normally it's things associated with simple things. You know, if somebody's, if there's been a fight scene in a property or there's been a murder, when you've just got blood in a room to clean up, there's not much smell. It's actually when the body fat has decomposed that you get this horrendous fallout, or flesh is decomposed, like you said with your chicken carcass. Yeah, and when that happens, then it's you've got lots of different things. You've got airborne smells. You've got particulate in the air that's moving around. So it's kind of about containing it and treating it. We used to use a product from the States called Last Resort, which was designed for removing the smell of skunks when they mask their territory, honestly. Yeah. But it was the smell from that was, well, I think was worse than the dead body. It was horrendous, you know. So we've gone through loads of different products. We even make our own now. As a company, we've sourced kind of chemists who make our own enzyme based products, which work really well.
Again, that's through that trial and tribulation of, you know, what works, what doesn't. And
yeah,
I think when people look at jobs like your own, a lot of them kind of jump to the conclusion, no, it's extremely morbid. But actually, I feel like we need people like you, because unfortunately the way of the world is that people die and there is crime scenes. And, you know, it's, you know, you look at police officers and the shit they have to deal with and the PTSD that some of them have from dealing with that. You know, we are so lucky, or I am so lucky, that they deal with that and I don't have to. And it's it's the same way with you or you know, people that do your job. And we as a society are very lucky that we don't have to see that horrendous shit. I think it's actually a great job that you guys do. When you look at the UK, what is the most common crime scene that you would clean?
I don't know whether... I mean, so this, we used to be called the National Academy of Crime Scene Cleaners, and we kind of changed the name of it to the Ultima Cleaning Academy for the training, because it's taken on so many different areas. Originally, when I first started, I thought crime scenes were going to be the kind of the only way that we were going to be needed. But most decompositions are just natural deaths. There's no crime related to it. I think the more complicated, there's a lot of people who will attempt to clean up stuff themselves. So when you've just got someone who's maybe choked to death, or they've taken an overdose, all that happens then is normally the body will just relax and the bowel and the bladder will release. So sometimes there's fallout from that, but sometimes that's just contained in people's clothing. So the undertaker may take that away. There has been this real awareness nationally since COVID that people now understand what decontamination means for sanitizing. So even after that, people would want us to go in and sanitize the whole building just in case there's been any transfer of body fluid to surfaces. But I think most common for us at the moment is hypodermic needle. We're doing loads of drug dens and collecting needles, right. Which is part of what we've ended up morphing into. We do loads of deodorizing, whether it's, you know, Mrs. Smith, who's got 30 cats in her house and you've got this fallout from that. So lots of deodorizing. We do loads and loads of police work. So custody cells where they're holding people, normally drunk and disorderlies, who act in a, you know, it's like a zoo in custody. It's bizarre. So you get lots of fallout from that. Police vehicles. So now if somebody spits into a police vehicle, that's classed as needing decontamination because hepatitis B lives for at least a week in that body fluid.
Right.
So gone are the days where they were just, you know, use the car again and again. It's confined to a compound until it's sanitized and cleaned. So I think most common crime scenes would probably be something related to fights and probably murders or issues where there's been two different people or two or three people a fallout. And that can happen, you know, in some high profile case that you see on the news, or it can just be your local student union where everyone's kicked off, or a Wetherspoons pub where you know, someone's fallen out with someone.
Got a knife.
But decompositions, because they're so difficult to clean up, very often they automatically come to organizations like ours because people have no idea where to start. It's not something you can attempt to do on your own.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned there that going into a better choice of words I should probably use here, but going into drug dens, essentially, and there's lots of, you know, people that have died of overdoses or dodgy needles, you know, whatever it might be. Do you see that? I know that there's this heroin epidemic, and I can certainly see it in Glasgow. You know, there's a lot more people that you can see are just spaced out. They're definitely on heroin, and it's horrible to see. Do you see more of that now than you used to?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I would love to say that the world is becoming a better place. I would love to say that society is learning from its mistakes, but I don't see it. I've not seen it since I started this. I was probably as a business, not because of the size of the company, just because of the amount of work that was out there. We were probably doing 2 or 3 needle picks a week. And now we're nationally probably doing about 30, 40,
probably
maybe 50 a week. Yeah. And that's in public areas, car parks, playgrounds, drug paraphernalia. There are drug dens as well. The police used to get us to kind of empty everything, take everything away. Now they just take samples of any cannabis that they're growing. Or that have been grown, and then just give us the building to get through. But yeah, I think we also see lots more evidence of estranged families, which is whereas probably go back 20 years, you might have a family all living quite close by. So if something bad happened, somebody would try and help to clean that up. But we get so many jobs where the family are now living abroad or living, you know, they've emigrated. And, you know, Aunt Maud, who's living in the middle of Bristol, no one knows how she is, whether she's alive. And then suddenly they become next of kin. And then we get a phone call. Lots of our stuff is done by WhatsApp video or by FaceTime to tell them, show them what we've done and what we cleaned. Or do you want us to throw this away? You know, what do you want us to do with all these possessions? That kind of thing. So, I think society has definitely changed. It's definitely worse. Drugs, even in our tiny little, you know, in West Wales, where genuinely there's more sheep than people where we live. and we come across, you know, the same stuff that is happening in cities all the time.
It is scary. Is it mostly heroin that is the drug? I remember I went to Australia and there's just this humongous meth epidemic.
Yeah.
And you see, I mean, I got up at 4 in the morning to shoot a sunrise in Sydney, I think it was. And just the amount of people that are just, they've got nothing behind the eyes. Yeah. They're just walking around and it's meth. Yeah. And I feel in Scotland, I'm not sure what it's like in England. Scotland, it's heroin for sure. Is it the same in England?
Yeah, it varies. There's a lot of crack cocaine around that's used as well. This zombie drug that's coming in now. I mean, we went to a property only a few weeks ago that we sent a team in. And bizarrely, they were injecting a cleaning fluid in between their toes to get high. And I have no idea what that related to or what it is. But we've also, bizarre. And but again, the fallout is exactly the same for us, whether it's a needle that's been used for heroin or whether it's one for Windoline that's been injected into someone. I have no idea why that's done or why people do that. But for us, it's just the increase in it, the increase. The only thing that's slightly changed as well is that I think the more people in society, the less we get massive issues. So if a property's been unused, say in the middle of a city, it's been boarded up, we used to find lots and lots and lots of these, whereas now there's a big push on taking care of those. I think there's quite a lot of towns and the government supports funding to improve towns. So whereby we used to have kind of lots and lots of properties above shops, which drug addicts have got into, we'd have like 4,000 or 5,000 needles to pick up, which we still do, but it's those largest.
Building in like one,
yeah, at least.
What?
We've done tons and tons of them where it's just been multiple. I mean, I don't know how many people have been in there using, kind of time scale. But any drug addict can go to the chemist and get a drug pack from the chemist free of charge, which contains like 10 needles, some swabs, wipes, a little spoon to boil up on. And we see these thrown everywhere. You end up actually, you've only got to have 10 people in one disused building and you've got 100 needles a day. And then it just kind of grows and grows and grows, you know? So,
that is terrifying.
Yeah.
That's utterly terrifying. NHS, is it the NHS or is it just... Is it the hospitals just give that for free?
Any medical center, so your local chemist, health center, so people who are going in there for methadone will also be given needles. It's changing. Also, they used to be given this grey bag with them all in, But I think that's been seen as identifying them as a drug user as they walk out of the shops. And now they get these funky little, looks like a sunglasses case, and with all of their needles in it, just to kind of hide the fact of what's in there. Yeah, bizarre.
It's sad. It's really sad as well when you see people that are like, you know, I've got friends that have definitely got addictive personalities, and like, you know, they can't stop. And you know what? It's really sad seeing these, you know, people that could have had such amazing lives, and they just go down the wrong path. And
And I think that as well as your question before about what is the most common thing, the probably other most common thing is suicide, which again is incredibly sad, because I think I think it's the biggest killer of men now under the age of 30, 35. I think over 1 million people committed suicide last year, not only in the UK, I think worldwide. But we see that constantly, people jumping off of buildings, some of them survive, which is even worse, I think. Mm. We go to a lot of places where people disembowel themselves to commit suicide, which you'd think, I have no idea why people do it, but just to put a knife into the stomach and cut it open. And the fallout from that is pretty horrendous. So we do a lot of disembowel cleanups, a lot of suicides relating to arterial wounds. Some are more common than others, but people jumping. We as a company do a little bit for rail companies, but there's lots of people. My son's father-in-law is a train driver, and I think he's been exposed to 3 or 4 suicide jumpers on his train journey just from Newcastle down to London. Hmm. So that's more common as well. So suicides, lots of them. And it's really, when you start looking, it's really strange, because our local university, a place called Aberystwyth, a really nice university. However, all of the windows now only open kind of 4 inches. And there's a reason for that. And people don't even think about it, you know, but actually, I suppose if you go back 10 years ago, if you left university with a degree, you're pretty much guaranteed a decent job. And now what are your prospects? It's a strange world. Things are people's aspirations, people's dreams, and mental health all play in that part. So suicide is probably the greatest cleanup we do, aside from needles and then accidents, just which are not crime scene, but just accidents that happen in workplace or road traffic accidents. We clean loads of road traffic accidents up as well, motorbikes and vehicles where people have come out of the car.
All right, let's just have a little break from some of these absolutely wild stories to talk about Chisholm Hunter, who are the sponsors of the Into the Mind podcast. Chisholm Hunter are a family-run jewelers that have been going for over 165 years. Yes, you heard me. They specialize in luxury watches and luxury jewelry. They have some brilliant brands, Chisholm Hunter being, of course, the most brilliant. But apart from Chisholm Hunter, they have stuff like Tag Heuer, Tudor, Omega, Vacheron Constantin, Blancpain Brett. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And the good thing is, they're actually authorized retailers for all of those brands. And in society nowadays, buying fakes is becoming a real issue, especially in the luxury watch industry. So to have a trusted jeweler that you can go to like Chisholm Hunter, it makes all the difference. So if you're looking for something for yourself or a loved one, head to chismhunter.co.uk. That's chismhunter.co.uk. And while you're on the Chisholm Hunter website, use code CHSUB, that is CHSUB, for an exclusive 10% off selected lines. And on that note, let's get back to the podcast.
I think with the mental health issue as well, a lot of it comes down to like having a purpose. And some people, you know, their purpose is that they love to hike. Some people that their purpose is, you know, they love to take photos. But a lot of people are missing that. They don't have that anymore. And maybe it's because they haven't been exposed to it, or maybe it's because they're in a job that they hate, that they can't get out of. I feel like in society nowadays, a lot more people are losing their purpose, their why. And because they've lost their why, they begin to live for the weekends because they can numb it with alcohol. And then all of a sudden you start seeing the spiral where it's alcohol, then it's weed, then it's cocaine, and then it's, you know, it spirals. And it's just so, so sad to see that suicide rate has increased. And with someone with, like, I've had personal exposure to things like this going on in my life with friends, and it's really
it's really heartbreaking. Does that impact you? Like, when you go into these crime scenes, would you say that the suicides impact you most in terms of your mental well-being?
I think, so we've trained probably about 4,000 people to do this work over the last 12 years. And I think they've all got a different approach to it. So we've got some people that go into a room and they will have a minute silence, light a little candle that they've taken with them. I've never felt the need to do any of that. I've kind of always just focused on the problem at hand, and I've got to solve that problem for whoever it is, the landlord, the family. So for me, it's always been just black and white what I need to do. Actually, with trying to write my memoirs down, which I've been doing lately, I've focused more on what's gone on in those situations for the family, which has made me feel actually quite sad, where I'd never really focused on it before. But I think specifically with suicide, when we clean that up, again, it used to be that the police suicide was not rare, but it was something that was quite treated with dignity by the police, and they would be involved. Now, kind of keys are just given back to landlords or to family. And we go in and there's still suicide notes on the side of the sofa, and we ask, what do you want us to do with them? And they say, oh, can you just throw them away? And I'm thinking, this is the reason why this person took their life, which I don't think there's anything more you could do to kind of show how harrowing you feel about a situation. And yet we're just throwing that away. So where we can, we find next of kin, or we try and preserve stuff or try and give it back to whoever we can. But it is traumatic. And when you read, you know, some of these notes kind of are that they've lost custody of their children and can't face, you know, moving on without them in their lives. And we've all got kids. All of my staff have got kids, and we all kind of, it is deep. I think that's a situation where you can't even dwell on it, because I think it would just make you the most depressing people in the world. You've just got to think, actually, what's happened has happened. There's nothing to do with us. It's not, I've not been a part of anything that's done this. However, I can make it better, either for the landlord financially or for the family, to deal with something they don't have to do themselves. So that's been my way of dealing with it, and lots of the people that work with us.
Yeah. And have you got one experience in terms of a cleanup that you think stands out from the rest in terms of being just the most horrific experience?
We've done lots. There was a few years ago, a guy down, I think it was in Plymouth, just walked around his local village with a shotgun and shot six people, which is normally something you kind of relate to happening in the States.
Yeah,
but that happened, and there was young and old. So we ended up cleaning that up, and one of our teams was quite local, so they knew some of the victims as well.
Oh my god!
So that was pretty horrendous. I've also personally cleaned up lots of scenes where a family dog has mauled a baby and killed their baby, and so then you get this real sensitive situation. But you've got family loved the pet, the family loved the child. No one thought this would ever happen, but the reality is it did. So that's been incredibly sensitive to clean up. And then other times, I think the one I mentioned to you that there was a 16-year-old lad who bizarrely in the UK you can have a shotgun if you're a member of a gun club at 16, but you can't buy a can of Stella.
Really?
You know, real strange. And this young lad, not very far from where we live, it was a couple of hours away, and he'd fallen out with his girlfriend at 16. And his parents were watching The X Factor on TV underneath. The grandparents lived next door, and he took his own life in his bedroom. You know, the noise from a shotgun, I do a little bit of, I've had a shotgun license because I have a farm for pest control and for animals and things. But the impact from that, from the family hearing that and having to run upstairs, open the door and see the fallout from that, I don't know how they would ever kind of get over that. And for me, having a son who was, you know, similar age, I think when you can relate it to your personal life, that's when it becomes difficult to deal with. One of our team, he went to clean up a suicide where a guy had a table saw in his garage, took the cover off the saw and put his throat on the saw, on the saw. And that's the way he ended his life. But again, surrounded by suicide notes of the court cases that he'd been to try and get custody of his children. I suppose there's a real deep conversation on if someone's mentally able to do that, are they going to be stable as parents? I don't know. But whatever the reason, the team that we sent could relate directly to losing custody of their children. And one of the guys, and they struggled with that. He even phoned us up and said, I don't think I can do it. So we're like, come away, you know, we'll send someone else to go and do it.
Yeah. So do you think, yeah. I know that doctors have a situation that because I had a pal called James, he's a doctor, and I said, oh, is it okay if you just look at this thing? Because I'm like a bit worried about it. And he said, no, I can't go near you because I know you and it's personal. Do you have the same thing? Like if it's someone that you know or a friend of a friend, you say, listen, I'm not going to get involved here because it will be mentally more traumatic.
Again, I can't speak for all the people that we've trained, but for me personally, no, I feel quite privileged to help them and feel that actually I'm able to support them through that. So we had I still do some lectures for young people in college, on universities, on kind of niche markets, entrepreneurship, looking for kind of ways they can solve really awkward specific problems that will help their business. And one of the college lecturers, she was lovely, we were really good friends, but her estranged partner, they'd split up, but she rang me and said, look, they've just found the body. He committed suicide in his loft, bizarrely. And that was over three floors. And she said, would you be able to come and clean it up? So, I was more than happy to help her and do it for us a favor, you know, and because I had a relationship, we were good friends, colleagues. So I think when that opportunity occurs, it's not very often it does. Most of the people you associate with and hang around with are people similar to yourselves. They have the kind of same outlook, but it's normally a friend of a friend of a friend if it comes through that kind of process of someone you've never met. But I would help the friend out. Although I did go to a property, it was kind of a big biomass plant where this gentleman decided to commit suicide with a ratchet strap and jumped off of a gantry in this big, huge kind of warehouse where they had these, it was boiling hot in there, this biomass plant, putting wood chip in one side and electric basically out of the other through this generator. And but unfortunately his head severed. So his head flicked up onto a ledge and his body then fell and hit a machine that was turning. So we had lots of fallout from it. And I knew the guy. I knew the guy. He lived just down the road from us. We got there and the undertaker had needed a set of ladders to go up and pick the head up and put it into a bag and bring it down and then clean up the rest of it. But that was so sometimes that happens. And the way we've developed the business nationally is we couldn't really employ people. It was really difficult because I didn't know how many people are going to crash in Bristol tonight or commit suicide. So we basically set up a network of trained cleaning companies, small owner-managed cleaning companies. And wherever we get a job come in, we pass it to them in their area. So sometimes they're really close by. One really interesting one was there's a company, a great company called Bespoke in Manchester. Guy called Wayne owns it, but he's also got a house. He had a holiday home in North Wales and he's now moved there. Really, really nice guy. And we phoned him up and said, look, we've had this job come in, a lorry has hit somebody on a road. All the body has been thrown all over the wheel arches, all inside the lorry, all under the engine bay. It's been taken into a compound behind a service station. Could you go and clean it up? Yeah, fine. And off he went and sent his team down there. And then about a week later, he phoned me up and he goes, do you know what? He goes, what I didn't realize was I was trying to get hold of the maintenance guy for our cottage. Couldn't get hold of him. I'm phoning him, leaving messages saying, look, please answer the phone. And then I saw in the paper that a signpost had blown over on the road. He got out of his car to to put the signpost back up, and a lorry hit him.
Oh my God.
So he'd cleaned the actual lorry up, where his maintenance guy, for his holiday home, it can become that close, you know, you just have no idea. So that was kind of very close to home for him, just because of, we have to pull in teams, but very often police and social services and councils and housing associations all want kind of a 2-hour reactive call out. So we've got to pull teams in who are fast, incredibly close. Yeah.
But you are right in terms of the disassociative aspect. I was speaking to a lady called Sue Black, really interesting lady on the podcast, and she was saying she would go to court and she would try to essentially arrest child predators. And there was a guy on the stand that his daughter, who was 6 years old, had turned on her webcam. So you can see the dad coming in the middle of the night, but the dad got away with it. And she said essentially that was so, for her, because she was so personally in touch with the project, because her daughter was that age, she said that was the biggest impact a court case has ever had in me. And from then on, I tried to just totally disassociate myself with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the only way you can do it. When you're doing these horrific experienced things, the only way to really do it is just totally disassociate yourself with the situation.
Yeah, I think I've managed to do that. Through the whole career, from the first job to all the other jobs I've done, I've managed to distance myself. I know it sounds kind of awful, but if somebody sends me a picture saying, "Can you clean this?" I will just very often see pound signs, thinking, actually, I'm only doing this for a business.
Yeah.
And I want to earn more than a living out of doing this because it's pretty horrendous. Therefore, that's my job.
Yeah.
Whereas someone who's doing this for a charity or exposed to some awful situation, if they're working in the NHS for kind of minimum wage, I think I would struggle to do that. You've got to be a certain mentality to cope with doing that kind of work. I mean, I very often think about, you know, say if somebody falls over, like an elderly person crossing the road, you've got a few kinds of people. You've got someone who will laugh thinking it's funny. You've got someone who will run straight over and help them. You've got someone who will walk away and just ignore it. You've got people who will want to watch to see what happens. There's all this kind of, and I think we're in that same business as well, where there's people who can cope with stuff, or been exposed to stuff. And I applaud the people who run over. But very often I'm the person that's laughing, which is also a terrible situation to be in.
And what would something like that cost? And forgive me for asking, but just out of pure curiosity, like if you had a suicide, for example, really unfortunately, horribly, you know, it is a tragic incident, but if they had hung themselves, would that cost more than, or would that cost less than, let's say, a shotgun suicide? Like how would that work?
Yeah, it's been a really difficult place to kind of price things up because it's a commercial enterprise. But the fallout, it creates the more work. Mm. So therefore, if there's been a shotgun suicide or a decomposition, then we would normally start those. Start them at a minimum of £750 for the cleanup, and then it can escalate. So we might have to go back to the client and say, actually, phase one was to get there and clean up what we could. Now we've lifted the carpet, they've decomposed through the floors, we've got to cut the flooring out. And it might have gone through the flooring into the ceiling below, and the ceiling below might contain Artex, which has got asbestos in it. So then it's another level and another level, another level. Shotgun suicides can be a farmer in a piggery or a dairy, which is really easy to clean up. You can sanitize, collect any body fluid, and then you can just jet wash down. Whereas if somebody's done it in a stairwell, you might have 30, 40 feet of surfaces, and you've got to get to those and manage your the platforms that you're working on to be able to work safely. You might have wallpaper, like wood chip wallpaper with shots right the way through them and tufts of hair, all that kind of stuff. So I think for most of the work we do, we had to set a pricing structure that would incentivize other cleaning companies to drop what they were doing and react for us. So it had to be worthwhile. So we actively, they make in kind of the region of £200 to £300 per hour minimum. And it escalates depending on their skill set. Sometimes it can become really awkward where, say, if somebody has, we cleaned up a situation where there was a local theme park and a young girl came out of a ride, passed away. But the impact of that was that she collided with steel structures on the roller coaster all the way down. So not only did you have to have a cleaning team that could get there very quickly, you had to have someone who could operate a cherry picker to work that high. And it becomes more and more complicated. So therefore, the cost of that increases and increases. We had one job for, I don't think it's wrong to say, it was for Shell Oil, had an office in central London. And they had a lift engineer working on their lift, and he put his arm in to try and reset something, but hadn't isolated it. Somebody called the lift and it took his arm off. And so the arm went up with the lift. He was rushed to hospital, and they then tried to catch the arm as they took the lift down to be able to take that to hospital as well to see if they could reattach it. And they missed it and it fell down to the base of the lift shaft. So then we've got confined space, we've got abseiling, plus we've got all of this, it's dark, pitch black in there, so you need lighting.
And then the risk as well.
Yeah. And so that job ended up being 3 or 4 days of health and safety executive involved and working along with them. So what was just a simple kind of cleanup eventually was thousands and thousands of pounds because of the complications that went along with it.
Jesus, that is...
Yeah.
And you've never had any form of, like, anxiety or issues with your mental health from this? Like, have you ever felt that way at all?
I said recounting and thinking about the situations. Looking back, there was one property in London where we went to, and there was a estate agent that was telling us how that this guy who lived next door, this Turkish man, was a horrendous, horrible guy. He paid his rent a year in advance just so he could run away back to Turkey and leave the place in an awful state, and it stunk. And so anyway, we drove all the way up to London to got the keys off and went in to clean it. And I walked in and knew that someone had died in there. I could smell it. And found a door that went down to a basement, and I could see his body at the bottom of the basement. And he'd been there for a year. But when they found him, he'd just broken his hips. That's all he'd done. So he'd been there. This poor guy, everyone thought was horrible, had been on the floor with broken hips, couldn't move. And how he passed away, whether it was starvation or whatever, but been down there for weeks and weeks and weeks. So looking back on that, whereas at the time, I just thought, I'm going to make 3 or 4,000 quid cleaning this. Now looking back, I think actually that poor guy, you know, imagine having to pass away like that. That was so there's been that happen since, but I think the only one I can really recall quite early in my career as well doing it was a job in Bournemouth for the major crime scene investigation team down there, where two professional people, the lady was a teacher and the guy worked in banking, husband and wife, but he'd bludgeoned his wife to death, and I think at the time they hadn't found the weapon, but it was probably the most violent, even to date, probably one of the most violent scenes I've been in. There was a policewoman in the dining room writing up her notes, and she just opened the door for us. And she told us that the woman had been on the floor for 3 days alive, and her neighbor found her. And then she died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. So there was that to deal with, this poor woman. But then the fallout from it, honestly, there was blood in drawers, blood underneath drawers, blood in lights, blood in light, even in sockets. We had to take sockets off the wall because there was blood in them. So it had been incredibly violent and sustained. And I think then I was driving home and there was one lad who worked for me, and we couldn't really talk. We struggled to make conversation because we were both thinking about it. And for me, you know, I was married, still am, been married for 25 years, and look back at that situation and think, oh, do you know what? If what point do you overstep that line of just having an argument and saying sorry or walking away? At what point do you inflict that much hurt on somebody? So that was something that really had an impact on me, I think. Really made me question why somebody would do it. I couldn't get my head around it, to take someone's life in that manner. So that had an impact. I remember my wife saying to me, what's wrong? I said, it's all right, you know, and it was only a couple of days and I'd forgotten about it because the next job had come in.
Yeah.
But from that point on, I said, when you've got some really sensitive situation where you feel for the person, but I've always felt walking away that I've left the place in a much better place than it was, or solved problems for people, which has been my kind of goal. That's the only two things I can relate to that one.
Yeah, and do you think, I have this theory about people that do mentally the stuff that puts their mind under extreme stress and pressure, whether that's you're in the army, SES, police officers, you know, I think as soon as you stop moving, your mind starts to create these issues become bigger that you've done previously. So for example, we've spoken to a couple of SES guys, and as soon as they stop what they're doing in the SES and come back to normal life, paying bills, paying taxes, going for a coffee, it's mundane to them. It's so boring because their brains are almost at a heightened level when they're out there that they get more, you know, more depression, they get more anxiety when they come back than when they're actually there. Is that something that you kind of like, when you do eventually retire, is that something you kind of worry about, that you're living at an elevated rate when you're doing these jobs, that when you stop, will that become more of an issue?
Yeah, I think, I do think that, so for me, I'm kind of very and often on the tools now. My kind of job role is training other people or directing what's going on and helping other people to kind of get into this industry. So I think that has happened. And, you know, the fact that I'm putting my memoirs together or unique situations that I've been in is allowing me to think about that more. And I think, yeah, you're right. It's it's difficult to, you know, I'm writing this book at the moment. It's difficult to write about a situation and not come away feeling so depressed from it, from writing that. It's a strange place. In fact, at some point I thought, what am I writing it for? What's the point in this? However, there's a massive interest around what we do and around this kind of line of work. So there's a benefit from it. There's also, I've always tried to highlight the professional side of it, which I'm proud of, that we actually, we do something very professional, we solve lots of really, really massive problems for people. However, I think the more you dwell on it, the more you think about it. So for me now, you know, we've got a farm, I've got Highland cows. Mm-hmm. I get more pleasure from just being out there in or doing things. I do quite a lot for charity. Those kind of things. I would struggle, I think, to go from that life to sitting in a room watching TV and doing nothing. I think, yeah, those people, like you said, who've been exposed to horrendous stuff in the military, it must be absolutely impossible to just drop to a normal life and not, you know, not have it affect you.
And do you think, as you're writing this book, so it's the life of a crime scene cleaner, isn't it?
Yeah.
So as you're writing this book, do you think that's kind of therapy to you in a way? You're kind of you're writing this book and you're going back over the situations that you've been in, and you're kind of processing them in your head.
I think I didn't want to do it for that reason. I wanted to do it for two reasons. One, I think I've been constantly asked by people, you know, if I go down the pub, everyone just says, "What's the worst thing you've ever cleaned up?" That's kind of, you get asked this continually. Yeah, and yeah. So I thought, actually, I'm going to put it down as those kind of thoughts, and those jobs we've done, there's that interest to it. There's a financial benefit, obviously, for myself from writing a book. I didn't think about the impact it would have. I think there is a, it has made, when we're training people now, my compassion for the situation is far greater than it ever was. Now I focused on what the other members of that family or colleagues had to deal with. for instance, that guy who hung himself in the biomass plant, I remember being there and I was just so focused on cleaning up. There were some elements that made it difficult, like the heat and the height and the trauma from it. There was sawdust everywhere, which had absorbed loads of it. So that made it easier. But I remember just looking up and there was an office with a window and I could see all the people in there, their silhouettes behind the curtain. And they were all his colleagues. And I think I never really thought about what they had to do, because they would have seen him hanging or seen his body hitting this machine, or some of them may have been exposed to the whole thing. And they're never going to see him again. They're never going to work with him again. So the impact from that on those people, I didn't even question it while I was there. But now I'm writing about it, thinking, actually, and what about his wife or his girlfriend or his mum or his dad who never saw him again? I was probably the last person to see any of him, which was a really, really strange thought when you get back to it. So part of me doesn't want to go there because I don't want to kind of get into a spiral of negativity. Part of me is also embraces the fact that we are professionals. We've made a difference, and we will continually make a difference for other people the more this world goes down the pan.
Yeah, and I think that part of that is when it comes to like aging. I think the part of your brain that actually processes risk versus reward, it's not fully developed. It's like your frontal cortex, something like that. It's not fully developed until you're 24. So when you're younger, you tend to take tons of risks because your brain hasn't fully formed. And then as you get older, that bit of your brain becomes more cognizant. It becomes more used. And you start thinking about these issues in a more balanced way, so to speak. You wouldn't just look at it.
That makes a lot of sense. Even when I was window cleaning, I used to be three floors up with my fingertips holding onto the side of a bay window, across. And you just look at it now and you just think, oh my days, what the risk I was taking for an extra 50p. And now all of our work is done with reach and wash window cleaning poles. And so no one has to take that risk. But you're right. I never even questioned it, even questioned it. And now, if I look back at myself, I think, what on earth was I doing? How overconfident was I, or not even taking the risk into place?
Yeah.
And the sad thing as well was when we first started, even the risks for what we were doing weren't known. So nobody knew that hepatitis B lived for 8 weeks in water or a week in dry body fluid.
8 weeks in water?
Yeah, 8 weeks it survives for. So surface off the coast of Cornwall, with raw sewage going into the sea, are an 80% chance, more chance of catching Hep B than anyone else in the UK, survives in seawater. And there's all of these other things that we don't know that we're being exposed to. So, I was really sad on the news last night. There was a whole item about the fur trade in China. I don't know if you saw that, but these poor little animals being kept in horrendous situations for their pelts. For just some luxury item, it just seemed horrendous. But the issue with biocides and potential infection that can transfer between animals and humans in that environment, similar to what they think COVID came from, those kind of, whether it came from bats in Wuhan or wherever it developed, that nearly every virus and every bacteria that affects humans badly is zoonotonic. It's come from animals. Therefore, that exposure, now we're made aware of this. There's bodies that make us aware of it, the World Health Organization, and people try to protect us. But back then there was nothing. Didn't have a clue. Not a clue. Nobody told us anything. It literally was, if you can clean tomato sauce off of a desk, you just crack on. And that's been a privilege to be able to actually teach people about those risks, and say to them, when we're doing our training, one of the most important parts is we say, have you thought about cross-contamination? If you're taking a photograph of your job that you're doing, have you sanitized your phone? Have you made sure you've not cross-contaminated? Because when you go home, you'll give your phone to your three-year-old who'll be playing games on it. And you just see people's faces just realize actually they've done this lots of times. They've exposed potentially infectious material to others without even thinking about it. So,
Yeah.
So it's good that that's changed. Yeah.
How many kids do you have?
Two. Yeah, two. Yeah. So yeah.
Did things change when you had the children?
Not really. I mean, it was probably when they were for me, when my son, he's 23 now, when he was born, the realization I had to kind of find some income for when I couldn't work. So I needed to try and earn, you know, I have a backup. And he started working for us, for our business. Sadly, he's still alive, but he got cancer when he was 20, when he was 16. No, it was fine. He had stage 4 cancer. And that was a really difficult time. But he had the all clear a few years ago, and he's now married and living in Newcastle.
Amazing, amazing.
Yeah, he's doing really well, really well. And my daughter, she's 19, just turned 20, and she worked for the business and then realized that she hated it. And she's dog grooming and doing pottery, which she loves, a bizarre kind of combination. But so that actually, for me, it's never had an impact on my work with the kids. I mean, when I go to a property and I'd cleaned up a situation where a baby had passed away, there was obviously that real sadness and the correlation to the fact that it hadn't happened to me. And I was really, you know, you'd come home and you'd hug your kids that night more than you would any other night. But there's not been an impact from the business. They've, what I thought my son and daughter would take on the mantle of what I could do. I thought it was something like a learned behavior that I could cope with this stuff. And then I've realized actually it isn't. They struggle with blood and struggle with cleanups and struggle with that. So I've never exposed them or pushed them into doing that line. They were office based or doing something unrelated or training related. Mm. So that's the other thing I realized, that they're not me and I'm not them. So so I've never forced them into that line of work or put them in that way. They're happy to kind of, you know, show people what I do, and because it's unique. But apart from that, I don't think they'd ever want to do it themselves.
Yeah, so you're either born with being able to handle that, you think, or
yeah,
not.
Or as a young person exposed to that, I think, I mean, I wouldn't have, from what my exposure was with farming, for example, I would have no qualms about going to a local farmer and say, look, I've got this job, would you come and give me a hand doing it? Because I think they would automatically relate to having to clean it up or clean up body fluid. Yeah. Yeah.
I think you're doing the right thing. I've been a family business, cause they can be really difficult, because the more you push your child into that, the more that they'll push against you. So yeah, it can be very, very difficult, but I think you've done the right thing there. It's, you know, if they want to, they follow their passion and you're not pushing them into anything.
Yeah.
That's probably the right thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, it was difficult for me because I wanted to set them up with a career.
Yeah.
But then I realized that kind of every time I tried to get them to do something that I thought would be beneficial for them, they just did the opposite. I just think, actually, now let's just, if I can set up a support for them whenever they need it, then and you know, it's been a really successful financial business for me. It's gone from, you know, window cleaning to a multi-million pound business. So it's so it's always there if they want to pick up anything, or it can support them doing whatever they want to do. So that's kind of a nice place to be.
Oh, for sure. And it's investing in what they want to do. And then maybe when they're of an age that they want to perhaps start a business or go into something, you can support,
yeah,
and be there for them.
Definitely. Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, I've just realized that we've ran 9 or 10 minutes over time.
Yeah.
So I'm so sorry for that.
But that's okay. That's okay.
Your book, when does it come out?
So it'll be just in the new year. Yeah. Just into the new year. So it's about 2 months away. So, kind of middle of January, it should be out. Yeah.
And lots to write, or are you kind of almost
there? Yeah, no, I've written it. It's just being edited. We've got a publisher now that's just taking it on. So they're just finalizing it and seeing what kind of pictures they want to add to it. I've got this whole catalogue of pictures to go along with each story. So it's kind of just working out what's not too macabre and what's quite sensitive. So that's all being put together. So that's quite good.
Wow, so you'll be actually putting pictures from the crime scenes that you've cleaned in the...
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. Wow, okay.
Yeah. So but I think people can relate to it, then they can see. I mean, whether they end up being black and white or they're, I don't know, we're kind of discussing that at the moment. But there's, I think if people specifically want to read a book about crime scene cleaning, that they're either going to be generating these images in their mind of what they think we're cleaning up or to actually see it. So the people who want to read that, I would think, would be kind of quite au fait with seeing those images.
Well, they're buying it. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. If there's any chance of just kind of mentioning as well, just if it can be added into the podcast at all, is that if anybody's thinking about coming on this kind of line of work, if it's something they've always been intrigued with, that we offer e-learning courses to be able to get into it, coupled with a face-to-face training and a confidence day where we set up all different scenes for them to clean. And help them through that. So that training is available through the Ultimate Cleaning Academy. So if somebody wants to come along, or they meet us when I'm there doing training, so we've got five other trainers as well. But it's a really good place to be, actually. It's a really nice place to be and see where people are coming from and appreciate what they're doing. I just quickly tell you, we had one lady come on our course, and we have lots of elements. So we had a pest control element where they get a certificate to use pesticide. And she turned around and said, "Oh, I don't want to do that." And she went outside and had a fag. And then we have another trainer that shows them how to cut into flooring to remove contaminated flooring. And they've got to be aware of, like, electric, water, heating pipes, etc. So she goes, "Oh, I'm not doing that." Went out and had a fag. And it was getting more and more bizarre, because we were thinking, how are we going to pass any work to her if she doesn't know how to do this kind of stuff? And then a week or 2 weeks after the course, I phoned her up and said, "Look, how was the course for you?" She said, "Oh, it was fantastic. I really enjoyed it." And I said, "Can I just ask you, do you realize we can't pass you work related to pest control or to decomposition?" She said, "No, I don't want any work from you." I said, "Oh, okay. What did you come on the course from?" And she goes, "Oh, I've set up a business sanitizing Brussels." And I was like, "You're kidding me." She goes, "No." She goes, "I charge £300 a Brussels." And she goes, or a massage parlor, if you're going to call them. And she does three a day. So she's on 900 quid a day. And she works 3 days a week. And I just thought, what an absolute genius. Yeah. And I'd never equated our training with that, you know. And we've got people, we had two cage fighters who came on the course, saw all this blood everywhere, and thought, actually, they could set up a business doing cage fight cleaning after the fights. So that's all they do now. We've got other people who sanitize and collect the little inflatable boats that are coming across from France with immigrants on, or lorries that have got immigrants in living that they've got in the back of them. Some do private jets where they've had some outlandish party and there's body fluid everywhere, and that's all they do. You know, so there's a real mix of work related to it, which has been really, it's a really nice place to hear people's stories. So cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something you can never get bored of, right? Because you've got so many different areas to get involved.
Definitely.
Private jets with tons of fluid. I can imagine what's going on there.
I know, just horrendous, you know. But it just, yeah, just it's an interesting to meet different people. In fact, on our last course, we had a charity called Not Going Back, who brought three men who'd been in prison, been released from prison. They want to start now cleaning crime scenes and working with us. So that charity, so to meet them, hear their background, their stories, why they want to get into this. Really, really interesting to meet all these different people. So it's a great place, even just to come on the course itself is just really interesting. But the business opportunities on top of it are really, really quite lucrative for anyone.
Yeah. Well, it's so specialized, isn't it? Like, I feel like wherever you get a specialized job, you can kind of quote, I mean, what you want to quote, because there's no competition.
Yeah, definitely. And that, I mean, that's the way I've always looked at it. All business does is solve problems. That's all it does. And if you can find a really unique problem, you can solve it faster, better, quicker. Whatever you can do, you can charge as much as you want for. So if people want to make more than a living out of doing a job, then and they can cope with it, then it's perfect. Especially if they've already got some element of cleaning to their kind of business, or they're happy doing that. It's a great bolt onto it.